Title today, Why is England Burning? England was burning this week. Its major cities were attacked from within. It's important for us to understand the causes of this. There are a lot of causes that people that people pointed to, and it's quite interesting some of the things they said and why they said it. It all began when a person was killed by a policeman. Conflicting reports have come out of that as to the kind of person it was or the circumstances in which he was killed. However, this seemed to be the reason for the attacks on the police to begin with in London. The first things that started coming out of people's mouths, especially the young people, they just simply can't kill somebody as if they just did it. And of course, it comes across in a certain way. There's some underlying anger that's there, and all of a sudden there are flashpoints, and off it goes. It's almost like when we were taught in the Boy Scouts, when you start a fire without matches, it's just you just keep doing the friction thing, you know, and it gets hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter, and it's all there ready to go, and then all of a sudden, boom, it bursts into flame when you have the right materials there. And this seemed to be the way it started in England. Later, as it spread, it seemed to have been orchestrated, mainly by young people, because they found that they could take advantage of a situation where the police simply could not stop it. There were not enough policemen around. They understood that there were not enough police on hand anywhere in sufficient numbers to stop the destruction, to stop them lighting fires and burning things and looting shops or whatever other destruction they wanted, or beating up on people, robbing people, to do whatever they wanted to do, and the general mayhem and the destruction that took place as a result. They did it primarily because they could. So we see something going on there. They moved about into unprotected areas, seemingly by some unknown hand, only to discover that their instant messaging through their BlackBerries would direct them to the next area where there were no police, or there was no or little protection, and the police could only react to what was happening. And by the time the police would show up, damage was already done. They already wreaked havoc all over certain, let's say, parts of London, not all over London, but certain areas of London. And then, of course, it spread to other cities, too. Why? After a while, it had absolutely nothing to do with the original cause. People were simply doing it. And it was lunacy when you look at what was taking place. But I've got something here I want to bring to you, but let me just cover something for you here in Ezekiel chapter 6. This is not the only place in the prophecies that it speaks of what Israel would experience in the end time. Ezekiel chapter 6, he says in verse 3, he tells Ezekiel to prophesy against them and say, O mountains of Israel, verse 3, hear the word of the Lord God. Thus says the Lord God to the mountains, to the hills, to the ravines, and to the valleys. Indeed, I will bring a sword against you, and I will destroy your high places. These are places where people gathered and did some local worship and of various kinds and various sorts, and things, of course, got out of hand in those areas. That's why God said not to do with them. Not to have that, because there was no central authority, but people were able then to begin to do their own thing. This is what a high place was. Then your altar shall be desolate, your incense altars shall be broken, and I will cast down your slain men before your idols, and I will lay the corpses of the children of Israel before their idols, and I will scatter your bones all around your altars. There were literal altars at that time. You simply have to make the application today as to say, well, what are we talking about? Well, we're talking about the things that people revere, that people look to, that people congregate around and form their life around. And there are a lot of things that people do, and a lot of it has to do with entertainment, if I can put it that way. We do have idols today. They just take on a different form than what they did then. He says, in all your dwelling places, the cities shall be laid waste. Let me just stop there. Your cities shall be laid waste. It goes on to indicate that this is going to be done by a foreign power. That's the way it was done. Verse 7, the slain shall fall in your midst, and you shall know that I am the Lord. In other words, when these things start to happen, people are going to say, was this ever talked about? Did we ever know? Did anybody ever tell us? And here's the theme of chapter 6, the theme of chapter 7. I've got them all marked here, all the way down to the end of chapter 7, when it says, then you shall know that I am the Lord. Because they don't know, which is part of the problem, as I think I can demonstrate to you very easily, and I'll bring that to you in just a moment. But that's the whole idea, they shall know that I am the Lord. They don't know him now. The Lord, God, God's way, reverence for God, the worship of God, God's commandments has been removed from Britain. It's gone. It's not there. All of our guys over there will tell you. They come over from England each year to our conference. I sit down and I talk to them, and they'll tell you, we just can't even talk about God in that country. Nobody even listens. They ridicule the whole idea. Now people are asking, where did we go wrong? And there is a lot of introspection. There is a lot of self-examination. They're not always coming up with the correct answers. There is a lot of blame to go around. And you find people doing that too. It's quite an amazing thing. Your cities shall be destroyed. Okay? This is what you're beginning to see. They're going to be desolate. They're going to be burnt. Isaiah says that. I'll read that to you in a little bit. Your cities are burning. Your cities are burned with fire, as Isaiah said in Isaiah chapter 1, right at the very beginning. Now, I'm going to read that in relation to something else I want to bring to you. However, this is very interesting here in chapter 7, in verse 12. The time has come, the day draws near. Let not the buyer rejoice, nor the seller mourn, for wrath is on their whole multitude. For the seller shall not return to what has been sold, though he may still be alive. For the vision concerns the whole multitude, and it shall not turn back. No one will strengthen himself who lives in iniquity. They have blown the trumpet and made everyone ready, but no one goes to battle, for my wrath is on all their multitude. Do people know what to do? Sure. There's a lot of things being said. Will they be able to rectify it? That's the question. Will they be able to change? Will they be able to return to what would have prevented this to start with? The sword is outside. The pestilence and famine is within. Whoever's in the field will die by the sword, and whoever's in the city, the famine and the pestilence will devour him. It's not going to be good, because once a nation is weakened internally, it becomes open to a lot of things. Famine is one of them. Pestilence is another. Attack from the outside is yet another. They simply lose their will to even defend themselves. I think that they have, where it says in verse 14 of chapter 7, they have blown the trumpet and made everyone ready, but no one goes to battle. Let me ask you one question right here. If you were a part of the military in England, and you were sent overseas to a place like Afghanistan, ostensibly to defend your country, ostensibly then to bring down extremism so that your country could be protected, so that the way of life in your country could be preserved, and you see what's happening in your country, why are you going to give your life for that? Why would you fight? Why would you put yourself on the line and say, I'll go to war, I'll join, at the beginning of America, It was a volunteer army. And it stayed that way for decades and decades until we went to war in World War I. And then we got people. Even then, it was largely volunteer, but then here's when the draft started to come in. People were ready to defend their country and go overseas from it. But when you see things going on like this, when people do not even care about themselves, they do not care, the leaders do not have the ability to say and speak the truth, nor even live the truth themselves, in order that it will pass down to everyone as it should be, then why are you going to put your life on the line for that? You need to think about that. You need to think about what this does to your military. You need to think about what this does to your ability to even defend yourself. It's a serious problem. It's bigger than what we tend to think. The UK has come to the point where it is laboring under the burden of a destruction and rebellion of a significant portion of their people. The people who once stood against the attack of Nazi Germany and rallied and fought them off and who carried on without panic, without complaining, who were disciplined, stood their ground, withstood the incessant bombing of their cities, and stood against the enemy in that way, persevered to the end, sacrificing, ready, willing to sacrifice themselves, now is experiencing a sickness where they are destroying themselves from within, destroying their own cities. David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, said that some pockets of the British society is not just broken, but sick. It's an interesting term. A poll was taken in Australia and asked Australians if they agreed with that statement. You want to guess how many people here in Australia agreed with that? 85% agreed with it. Yeah, we agree with you. We think 85% of you are sick. Or let's say 85% of us think that you got a sickness that's very, very serious. I mean, I wanted to correct that. I didn't say that right to start with. But they agree that that's the case. I don't know if they would see it. I think maybe they're starting to. However, do they know how to get back? Hosea chapter 7. I simply want to start showing you how when God says something, he knows what he's talking about. And I'll tell you about that in just a moment. How could he possibly know that it would come to this? Chapter 7 of Hosea is about Israel. It speaks of Ephraim. But now let me just say something here. He uses the word Ephraim, and we understand Ephraim. Or Ephraim, as we would understand it today, is the descendants, or let's say the British people, or the descendants of that particular tribe. However, the word Ephraim then was the leader of the northern 10 tribes, and so we're talking about all of Israel, of the northern 10 tribes. So it should be understood. And that's how it was meant historically, not just Ephraim, but that's where the capital was. That was the leader of the tribes. So therefore, when it says Ephraim, we're talking about all of the northern 10 tribes of Israel. He says, chapter 7, verse 1, I would have healed Israel. I would have healed you when the iniquity of Ephraim was uncovered, and the wickedness of Samaria, for they have committed fraud. A thief comes in, a band of robbers take spoils outside. They do not consider it in their hearts that I remember all their wickedness, and now their own deeds have surrounded them. They are before my face. They make a king glad with their wickedness and princes with their lies. You're talking about politics? That's what it talks about here. It's not what's right, not what's best for the people. It's not what a person should do, what a society should do. It's politics. They're all adulterers, like an oven heated by a baker. He ceases stirring the fire after kneading the dough until it is leavened. And in the day of our king, princes have made him sick, inflamed with wine. He stretches out his hand with scoffers. They prepare their heart like an oven. They lie in wait. Their baker sleeps all night. In the morning, it burns like a flaming fire. They are all hot like an oven. They have devoured their judges. Their kings have fallen. None among them calls upon me. In other words, it looks like they're going to do something, but they really don't. Ephraim has mixed himself among the peoples. Ephraim is a cake unturned. Aliens have devoured his strength. He does not know it. Yes, gray hairs are here and there upon him, and that is kind of and he does not know it. That's kind of a takeoff of a man in his middle-age crisis, or let's say he's beyond that and he thinks he's still young. he's all gray, man. This guy doesn't even know it. He's old. He's at the end. And the pride of Israel testifies to his face, but they do not return to the Lord their God nor seek him for all of this. Ephraim is also like a silly dove without sense. They call to Egypt. They go to Assyria. Wherever they go, I will spread my net on them and I will bring them down. In other words, they're going to find any other way of getting out of the problem except to do what's right. They'll go elsewhere. The entire chapter, of course, is very instructive. The whole book of Hosea is very instructive. How do you get into a situation like this? What happens? As a country, as a nation, a people. This is how we're being judged, by the way. Our nations are being judged. Oh, true, individuals are. But nations as a whole are being judged now, right now, by God. How do you get into this? Now, here's the way this thing is being looked at. Why did this happen? I ought to give you A, B, C, and D. One, not enough police on hand. This wouldn't have happened. So look what's happened. So we bring more police in and we stop the rioting with more police. A, take your pick here. Two, poverty and unemployment. B, how many choose B? Three, alcohol. That was the cause of it. D, young people. It's just the way they are. E, none of the above. I choose E. Because it's not, these are factors. This is not the cause. It goes a lot deeper than that. Two girls who took part in the Monday night riots in Croydon have boasted, and this really went out, that they were showing the police and the rich that we can do what we want. Now you're getting a little bit closer to the way things really are in the minds and in the hearts of people. That is sick. This is the product of not just the young people you saw there. What you saw last week is the product of generations. It started happening a long time ago, not just recently. You see, when you start going down a path that you think is right and you ignore the wisdom of the ages, the wisdom from the Bible, you're going to have a result and not know how you got there. Now, God says, I know exactly what's going to happen to you. I can tell you what's going to happen to you. How do I know? He is the one who knows cause and effect better than anybody. This has been said right from the very beginning. I'm going to read you a couple of more chapters, another chapter as to on the cause and effect. God can make predictions for 50 generations in advance and say, this is going to happen to you because I see here's what you're doing over here. This is not hard for God. He's seen this for all eternity. He's seen what happens. He says, if you make this decision, if you start thinking like this, if you start this particular practice, if you start departing from my commandments, this is what's going to happen. I can tell you what's going to happen beforehand. In fact, he says, I'm telling you now. We're going to read one of those chapters. I said, this is what's going to happen. And you think you're going to beat the odds. He says, you're not going to beat the odds. It's going to happen to you. Of course, he can prophesy for two reasons. The first one is he knows exactly how it's all going to turn out. He knows the beginning from the end, partly because he can bring it about or he can cause certain events to happen according to his plan, but he just understands the natural way things are going to go. The Bible's full of it. It is so full of it. You can't hardly read any passage in the Bible without understanding that if you do this, something over here is going to happen. There's going to be a blessing or there's going to be a consequence. And he says there's a way of life that a person ought to live that causes this. Now, at this point, I did a lot of research to try to find somebody somewhere who seemed to have, from England, not from Australia, not from America, but from England, who may have had a handle on this, or some kind of a handle. And I found the person. It was a woman. There were people like Deborah in the Bible who had a handle on things. I said, don't you understand what's happening to you, guys? Let's get going. She's an author and a journalist by the name of Melanie Phillips. She writes for the Daily Mail. Plus, she has authored a book that I do want to get. But you can check her out on the website if you want. I read what she has to write, and I subscribed for her email right away. I said, now here's a person who's got something going. Now, let's do a little bit of heads-up, smart thinking analysis of some things. But keep in mind, what she says, I believe, is right, with the exception of the politics part, which I'm not into, and I don't think we should be, because she's laying it off on certain political entities in some ways. Now, in some ways, she's right. But it's more than that. As he says, it's the whole country. God says the whole multitude. Everybody has got to start looking at themselves if you're going to correct the situation here. And some good leadership is going to have to come out of this, which, of course, remains to be seen whether it will or not. In times there have been, good leadership has come out. Times there haven't. It did in the book of Judges, when God raised up leaders to get the people out of the horrible captivity and the oppression that they were living under from an outside source and brought them back to God so that they were not under oppression. But people don't want to obey God. They want to depart from that. How the Liberals Ruined Britain is her title. She writes every day. But just listen to what she has to say, and I'll try to put it to you in a way where I think we can get a handle on some of this. So now the chickens have well and truly come home terrifyingly to roost. The violent anarchy that has taken hold of British cities is the all-too-predictable outcome of a three-decade liberal experience which tore up virtually every basic social value. And when it says liberal, it doesn't mean the Liberal Party. That's not what she's saying. It means liberal or progressive, that type of thinking. Okay. The married two-parent family, educational meritocracy, punishment of criminals, national identity, enforcement of the drug laws, and many more fundamental conventions were all smashed by a liberal intelligentsia hell-bent on a revolutionary transformation of society. Those of us who warned over the years that they were playing with fire were sneered at and smeared as right-wing nutters who wanted to turn the clock back to some mythical golden age. Now we can see what they have brought about in the unprecedented and horrific scenes of mob violence with homes and businesses going up in flames and epidemic looting. Clearly, there is some as yet unidentified direction and coordination behind the anarchy. But what is so notable and distressing is that after the first day when adults were clearly involved, this mayhem had been carried out in the main by teenagers and children, some as young as 8. The idea that they should not steal other people's property or beat up and rob passersby appears to be as weird and outlandish to them as the suggestion that they should fly to the moon. These youths feel absolutely entitled to go on the rob, as they call it there, and steal whatever they want. Indeed, they are incredulous that anyone should suggest that they might pass up such an opportunity. What has been fueling all of this is not poverty, as has been so predictably been claimed, but moral collapse. What we have been experiencing is a complete breakdown of civilized behavior among children and young people, straight out of William Golding's seminal novel about childhood savagery, The Lord of the Flies. There has been much bewildered talk about feral children and desperate calls upon their parents to keep them in at night and ask them about any stolen goods they are bringing home, as if there were responsible parents in such homes. We are not merely up against feral children, but feral parents. Of course, these parents know their children are out on the street. Of course, they see them staggering back with what they have looted, but either they are too drunk or drugged or otherwise out of it to care, or else they are helping themselves to the proceeds too. As David Cameron observed yesterday, there is clearly pockets of society that are not just broken, but sick. The causes of this sickness are many and complex. But 3 things can be said with certainty. Every one of them is the fault of the liberal intelligentsia. Every one of them was instituted and exacerbated by the labor government. And at the very heart of these problems lies the breakdown of the family. Once again, I'm not into the politics of what party did what or something like that. But she is, and she probably has a point, but there's a bigger point here to be understood. For most of these children come from lone mother households, and the single most crucial factor behind all this mayhem is the willed removal of the most important thing that socializes children and turns them from feral savages into civilized citizens, a father who is committed, a fully committed member of the family unit. Of course, there are many lone parents who do a tremendous job, but we're talking here about widespread social collapse. And there are whole areas of Britain, white as well as black, where committed fathers are a wholly unknown phenomenon. In such areas, successive generations are being brought up only by mothers. Successive generations, we have a key here, okay? Successive generations are being brought up only by mothers through whose houses pass transitory males by whom these women have yet more children and who inevitably repeat the pattern of lone and dysfunctional parenting. The result is fatherless boys who are consumed by an existential rage and desperate emotional need, and who take out the damage done to them by lashing out from infancy at everyone around them. In other words, I've been done badly by here in life, therefore I have a right to vent my rage in any way I want to. They're entitled to do this. That's the idea there. Such children inhabit what is effectively a different world from the rest of society. It is a world without any boundaries or rules. a world of emotional and physical chaos, a world where a child responds to the slightest setback or disagreement by resorting to violence. We ought to stop that, folks, in our own homes. They don't resort to violence for no reason, well, for any reason. A world where the parent is unwilling or incapable of providing the loving and disciplined framework that a child needs in order to thrive. Yet instead of lone parenthood being regarded as a tragedy for individuals and a catastrophe for society, it has been redefined as right. When labor came to power in 1997, it set out systematically destroying not just the traditional family, but the very idea that married parents were better for children than any other arrangement. Instead, it introduced the sexual free-for-all of lifestyle choice, claimed that the idea of the male breadwinner was a sexist anachronism, and told girls that they could and should go it alone as mothers. That's it. No commitment. Don't work it out. Don't think of the children. Just go it alone. And we'll make it possible for you. This was the outcome of the shattering defeat of Tony Blair in the 2 years or so after he came to power at the hands of the ultra-feminist and apostles of non-judgmentalism in his cabinet and party, who were determined above all to destroy the traditional nuclear family. Blair stood virtually alone against them and lost. One of these ultra-feminist wreckers is Harriet Harman. She doesn't mind naming people here. The other night, she was on TV preposterously suggesting that cuts in educational allowances or youth workers had something to do with young people torching and looting shops, robbing and leaving people for dead in the streets. But Harman was one of the principal forces in the labor government behind the promotion of lone parenthood and the marginalization of fathers. If anyone should be blamed for bringing about the conditions which have led to these appalling scenes in our cities, it is surely Ms. Harman. Now, I don't mind reading that for the simple reason you have had voices in the past. You've heard them. They've authored books. They've put out articles. They're the teachers in our universities who subscribe to the very same thing. We ought to be careful of these kind of people. And this breaking of the family was further condoned, rewarded and encouraged by the welfare state, which conceives of need solely in terms of absence of money, and which accordingly subsides lone parenthood and the destructive behavior that fatherlessness brings in its train. Welfare dependency further created the entitlement culture that the looters so egregiously display. It taught them that the world owed them a living. It taught them that their actions had no consequences. It taught them that the world revolved around themselves. The result of this toxic combination of welfare and non-judgmentalism was an explosion of elective lone parenthood and dysfunctional behavior transmitted down through the generations at the very bottom of the social heap, creating, in effect, a class apart. Once, children would have been rescued from their disadvantaged backgrounds by schools, which gave them not just education, but structure and purpose in their lives. But liberal intelligentsia destroyed that escape route too, for its onslaught upon marriage, the bedrock institution of society, with a tax system that penalizes married couples with a wife who doesn't work, was replicated by an onslaught upon the understanding and very identity of that society. Instead of transmitting knowledge to children, teaching was deemed to be an attack upon the child's autonomy and self-esteem. Now, she said a lot in this. One particular paragraph I just read to you, you know, about the tax system and so on, which is true. There's another thought I had on that. It may come a little bit later on. It was part of the problem. Thus it was that teachers adopted the child-centered approach, which expected children not only to learn for themselves, but also to decide for themselves about behavior such as sexual morality and drug taking. That's right. Now, what I remember now what I wanted to say, is that, you know, and I hear this today. I see it right here. The schools are attacked simply because they can't deal with behavior. And that's true. They ought to be given the ability to do that. But why are children misbehaving at schools to start with? I don't think anybody's ever asked that kind of a question. You know, there was a time that if I misbehaved in school, guess what my dad would do? All right. I wouldn't permit it. And I wouldn't stop a teacher from the proper discipline if needed to be done with my own children. In fact, I would have something to say about it myself. If it was unjust, or there was another side to it, which the child is all too willing to give sometimes, then I'd look into it. But a lot of times, we have to realize we're out here among people, and we got to live with people, and things happen. And there's a lot of things they have to learn. All right. The outcome was that children were left illiterate and innumerate and unable to think. Abandoned to wander through the world without any guidance, they predictably ended up without any moral compass. There's a lot I could read to you on that from other people, but the teachers couldn't do anything with it. They can't. You can say, well, I'll put a cross against your name. They say, okay. And they still misbehave. Nothing going on there. All of this was compounded still further by the disaster of multiculturalism. She's not afraid to speak out on this. The doctrine which held that no culture could be considered superior to any other because that was racist. And it's not. Not racist. It's just a matter of you're going to have to agree upon the standard. There's got to be a reference. There's got to be a culture that everybody agrees upon, that is right, and that is based upon an authority that you can absolutely count on. And that's what Israel had. I'm talking about Israel of the Bible had, or for a short time. Now, of course, we've removed all of that. It meant children were no longer taught about the nation in which they lived and about its culture. So not only were they left in ignorance of their own society, but any attachment to a shared and overarching culture was deliberately shattered. Instead of forging social bonds, multiculturalism dissolved them and introduced instead a primitive war of all against all, in which the strongest groups would destroy the weak. You know, when you agree upon your cultural standards, yes, it can work. But they're not doing that. You got to agree to that. And the agreement should be that the God in heaven is the authority, and his commandments are what is right. Instead of forging social, I read that. Okay. Closer related to this was victim culture, in which all minority groups were regarded as victims of the majority. So any bad behavior by them was excused and blamed it on the majority. I find it very interesting. You know, the sociologists want to put us in various groups. Well, we're in various groups now. You folks filled out a census. You had to give your religion. You had to give your racial background and everything else. You're asked for that. And so you can have some things. There's some basic things that have to be agreed upon in any society, and everybody's going to have to go along with it. Otherwise, it's not going to work. You're going to have problems. They have problems there. In a similar vein, all criminal wrongdoing was excused on the basis of the criminal. The criminal couldn't help himself, as he was the victim of circumstances such as poverty, unemployment, or as yet illusory cuts in public spending. That is, they haven't come yet, but we know they're going to come, so I'm going to be mad about it. The human rights of the criminal became seen as more important than the safety and security of its victims. Punishment became a dirty word, so the entire criminal justice system turned into a sick joke. with young hoodlums walking off with community sentences or ABSOS, that is antisocial behavior orders, which they held in total contempt. Mr. Cameron has declared that all those convicted of violent disorder in these riots will go to prison. Really? Isn't it more likely that they will end up on some community penalty, which will see them on trips to Alton Towers to make up for their disadvantaged upbringing? This is the normal response to our sentimentalized and addle-brained criminal justice officials. In short, what we've seen unfolding before our horrified gaze over the past 4 days in Britain is the true legacy of the labor years. And I'm here to tell you it's not just labor. This is generational. You need to go back a long time to begin to see the beginning of this. The social and moral breakdown behind the riots was deliberately willed upon Britain by left-wing politicians and other middle-class ideologues who wrap utter contempt for the poor in the mantle of progressive and non-judgmentalism. There are people who, against the evidence and mountains of empirical speech, research, against the evidence of a mountain of empirical research, hurl execrations at anyone who suggests that lone parenthood is, in general, a catastrophe for children and a disaster for women, who promote drug liberalization, oppose selective education while paying for private tutors for their own children, and call those who oppose unlimited immigration and multiculturalism racist. In other words, it says, these people are not being led in the right way. Policies are wrong, and there is no leader to tell them what is right. And the real victims of these people who know best are always those at the bottom of the social heap, who possess neither the money nor the social or the intellectual resources to cushion them against the most catastrophic effects of such nonsense. Britain was once an ordered society that was the envy of the world, the most civilized, the most gentle, and law-abiding. I can remember going there in the early 60s. I lived for 2 years there. The police carried no guns. I came from America, where you were armed to the teeth. In Britain, they carried no guns. I said, are they crazy? And seemed to work then. Not anymore. Can broken Britain be put together again? David Cameron is commendably talking tough. But will he have the stomach for tough action? Will he, for example, remove incentives to girls and women who have babies outside marriage? Will he dismantle the concept of entitlement from the welfare state? Will he vigorously enforce drug laws? Will he end the kid glove treatment of victim groups and hold them to account for their behavior in exactly the same way as everyone else? Repairing this terrible damage also means, dare I say it, a return to the energetic transmission of biblical authority. Thank you. Somebody said it. Anyone heard from the Archbishop of Canterbury about the riots? Anyone care to guess what he will eventually say about them? Quite. When church leaders stop prattling like soft-headed social workers and start preaching once again. The moral concepts that underlie our civilization, and when our political leaders decide to oppose the culture war that has been waged against that civilization rather than supinely acquiescing in its destruction, then and only then will we start to get grips with the terrible problem. Until then, within the smoldering embers of our smashed and burned out cities, we can only look upon the ruins of Britain we have so dearly loved. The Britain that once led the world toward civilization, but is now so tragically leading the way out. Quite good. Like I said, I did a lot of reading. She was the one who said it. wanted to bring that to you. I'm on her list now. And you can be too if you want to be. I was very impressed. But it took somebody to stand up and say it. I'm not so sure they'll have the ability to do that or to change. Isaiah chapter 1. Verse 2. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. The ox knows its owner. The donkey his master's crib. But Israel does not know. My people do not consider. Alas, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a brood of evildoers, children who are corruptors, they have forsaken the Lord. They have provoked to anger the Holy One of Israel. They have turned away backwards. Why should you be stricken again? You will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick. The whole heart faints. Are people encouraged anymore? Are people up about things anymore? Do they believe in the future anymore? The whole heart faints. From the sole of the foot even to the head, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. They have not been closed or bound up or soothed with ointment. Your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Strangers devour your land in your presence. And it is desolate, as overthrown by strangers. So the daughter of Zion is left as a booth in a vineyard, as a hut in a garden of cucumbers, as a besieged city. And unless the Lord of hosts has left to us a very small remnant, we would have become like Sodom and we would be like Gomorrah. There's a lot he has to say here. In chapter 3, I read this to you several weeks ago. Verse 4, Isaiah 3, verse 4. I will give children to be their princes. What does it mean by that? Children who do not know the way to go. There is no wisdom. They cannot understand the end from the beginning. They don't know if you take a certain action or a certain behavior or allow a certain culture among within the nation, within society, they cannot understand what will happen. When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I didn't know. My father would look at me and he would say, "Son, if you continue to do this, here's the way it's going to turn out." Once in a while, I decided to defy the odds. And I found out it didn't work. He was always right. He knew the way it would go. He knew what would happen. Children or our princes, they don't know. There is no wisdom. Babes will rule over them. They can't tell you what's going to happen if you adopt a certain ideology, a certain intelligence. She called it the intelligentsia. They say they know. The people will be oppressed, and everyone by another, and everyone by his neighbor, and the child will be insolent toward the elder and the base toward the honorable. You now have an unraveling of society in which you become so weak, your financial system is in tatters, your military grows weaker, the resolve of the people, there is no ability to resist your problems, nor ability to resist an enemy should one decide to take what you have, or which, in our case, what we've been given so abundantly. Deuteronomy 6, I appreciate Breen reading this. Let me conclude with this chapter. Let's think about it. Now, you need to understand the first few chapters of Deuteronomy. It's important to do that. They're about to go into the promised land, and he says, there's some things you always, always, always have to remember, and if you don't do it, here's what's going to happen. And it did happen. How did Moses know this? How did God know this? They understood cause and effect. They understood if you're going to do something, this is the way it's going to turn out. Chapter 5, I'm just going to break in chapter 5. Down toward the end, after the Ten Commandments were given, he says to them, now, therefore, verse 32, chapter 5, you shall be careful to do as the Lord your God has commanded you. You shall not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. You shall walk in all the ways which the Lord your God has commanded you, that you may live, and that it may be well with you, and that you may prolong your days in the land in which you possess. It's going to be shortened, unfortunately. Now, he said all the ways. Now, where does this start? Very little, very small. Little by little, a doing away with this, and a doing away with that, and thinking you can compromise on God's commandments. And you can say, well, this is not important, that's not important, so on. You start doing it. Keep going down that road and see what happens to you. And this is what he's warning them against, right at the end of the chapter on the Ten Commandments. Now he starts chapter 6. I want you to notice what he says in this context. Now this is the commandment, and these are the statutes and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded to teach you, that you may observe them in the land which you are crossing over to possess, that you may fear the Lord your God to keep all his statutes and commandments which I command you, you and your son and your grandson. I'm saying this is generational that we're talking about here. The causes that we see in England today go back more than just one generation or two generations. It goes back a lot further than that. Because somewhere, somebody decided to take shortcuts. They don't have to do what was right. And if it was a king, which there were a lot of them and still are, decide not to do what's right. Now, what do you think the people are going to do? Maybe there are one or two good ones. But if they're going to live like alley cats, and they're going to just simply do whatever they want to do, what do you think the people are going to do? It's not just the labor government, folks. This is endemic to the entire society. Now, but he says, this is what you got to do. All of you got to do this. He's saying to the people. You teach your command, you keep the commandments, you keep the commandments. And then you teach your children to keep the commandments. You don't keep the commandments, you can't expect your children to keep the commandments. It's generational. I thought she put it very well. We're not talking about feral children. We're talking about feral parents here. I heard another person say one time about illegitimate children, sometimes how disadvantaged they are. It's not. We don't have illegitimate children. We've got illegitimate parents. You got a lot of that stuff going on. People who should know better and should have enough maturity to say, yes, I see what's happening, and I'll change. And they can't, because they're children. And they've got to be, somebody got to look after them. Who's looking after them? And it just goes on. Therefore, hear, O Israel, and be careful to observe it. Be careful to observe it, that it may be well with you. You get it, let it get started, and you're going to start going down a track in which you're not going to be able to find your way back out again. You won't know how you got there. That you may multiply greatly as the Lord your God of your fathers has promised you, a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord with all your God, with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children. This is not an aside. This is not a, oh, by the way, let's talk about the Lord here for a couple of minutes for the week. That's not what it says here. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up, and you shall bind them as a sign upon your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes, and you shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates. And then when you have one of your children decide to take a shortcut and get what he wants by throwing a tantrum, you deal with it. Said, this is not our way. We don't do that. So it shall be, verse 10, when the Lord your God brings you into the land which he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you large and beautiful cities which you did not build. And they were large and beautiful cities. Houses full of all good things which you did not fill. Hewn out wells which you did not dig. Vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant. And when you have eaten and are full, then beware, lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. You shall fear the Lord your God and serve him and shall take oaths in his name. In other words, he's going to be a part of everything you do, everything you say, everything you intend to do. He's a part of every plan that you have. Either God is there or he's not. That's what this means. You shall not go after other gods, the gods of the people who are around you. For the Lord your God is a jealous God among you, lest the anger of the Lord your God be aroused against you and destroy you from the face of the earth. You shall not tempt the Lord your God as you tempted him in Massah. You shall diligently keep the commandments of the Lord your God, his testimony, and the statutes which he commanded you, and you shall do what is right and good in the sight of the Lord, that it may be well with you, and that you may go in and possess the good land which the Lord swore to your fathers. He says, I want it to go well with you. And this is the only way it's going to happen. To cast out your enemies from before you, as the Lord has spoken. And when your son asks you in time to come, saying, what is the meaning of these testimonies, the statutes, the judgments which the Lord our God has commanded you, then you shall say to your son, we were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, and the Lord showed signs and wonders before our eyes, great and severe against Egypt, Pharaoh and all his household. And then he brought us up out of there, that he might bring us in to give us the land which he swore to our fathers. And the Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God, for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as at this day. It's good to obey God. It's right. You save yourself so many problems, but people want shortcuts. They're so demanding. They're going to get what they want. They're going to get it now. They're entitled. They're not going to work for it. They're not going to turn to God. They're not going to turn to the values that God says that would make you great. Now, it is true that the older generations embarked upon policies that allowed people and gave people whatever they wanted to have. And where financial policies that go back for decades and decades and decades, a long time. And we've got what we've got today. That's why we're in the problems we're in today. I'll tell you what's the only thing that's going to work for us. Get out of the financial situation. You're going to have to work. You're going to have to work harder. You're going to have to work longer and quit borrowing money. You're going to have to produce. Now, that's a principle. People don't want to do that. You've got to bite the bullet. You've got to do the hard thing. You've got to pay the piper. You've got to pay the price. has to happen. You're not going to do it. Then it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to observe all these commandments before the Lord our God as he has commanded us. It will be righteousness. That is, it will be good. You will have right results, good results, the way things ought to be. Things turn out right. It's predictable. If you don't do it, it's also predictable. Chapter 7 is instructive. Chapter 8 is instructive. You ought to take those chapters together. Very interesting what he has to say, because he's able to say to a nation, to a society, and in our case, a whole civilization. Civilizations have come and gone. If you depart from this, if you go in some other way, if you allow in false gods, false teachings, and start changing things from what God says here, this is where you're going to wind up. He understands the end from the beginning, and he can tell you that. It is my prayer, it would be my hope, that the people of God would be able to say, here's where I stand. Here's what I'm going to do. Doesn't matter what anybody else does. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to obey God. That's what we're about. But the Church of God is able to stand on the Word of God, keep his commandments, and obey him, follow his plan and purpose. He is our God. You worship him, and he steps in, and he backs it up, and he blesses you as a result. Now, he's called us similar to what he called them. And he says, the big instruction here, not only do you keep them, you are a person of integrity all the way through, but you teach them to your children so that they do it. Kind of hard for one generation after the other to keep going in it. Maybe that's why. Let's do that, folks. Let's think about the terrible lessons that we see out here in front of us that are taking place and that we cry over, we weep over, we lament over, and how terrible it is. God said it. I think maybe that's one of the few comforts we can take out of it. And there's more yet to happen. But in the end of the day, God is going to bring a chastisement because we refuse to be disciplined. And then out of that is going to come a much better society brought about by him. That's the good part of the story. Thanks for coming today. And it'll be a little while before I see you again, but thanks again, and we'll see you soon.